Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the military conflict that erupted between Israel and Hamas was accompanied by the following tweet. The IDF has begun a widespread campaign on terror sites, ampersand, operatives, in the pound sign Gaza Strip, chief among them pound sign Hamas, ampersand, Islamic Jihad targets. From the beginning of the campaign, both the Israeli Defense Force and Hamas have been active in both describing attacks and spreading propaganda messages on Twitter and other online social networks. To discuss this development and the use of social media to break news is Doug Haddix, director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Reporting at Ohio State University. Welcome back to the show, Doug.
Thank you for having me.
So, what have you made of this social media warfare, a la Israel and Hamas?
I think it's a new battleground for hearts and minds. There's always been, in war and conflict, the efforts to try to get people, public opinion on your side. Now the tools are different and they're much more immediate than they were during the Vietnam War, during Korea, certainly World War II.
But I suppose if you don't fill that, it's like a vacuum. If you don't fill it with something, someone else will.
That's absolutely right. And there's so much immediacy now. We saw with the Gaza conflict, people in Gaza and the Gaza Strip were posting photos on Twitter and Facebook status updates immediately as the rockets landed. And they were posting horrifying images of burned children and decapitated folks and people who had just been horribly wounded during the attacks. So the Israelis could not ignore that, obviously. And they ramped up their own social media efforts to get their message out as broadly as possible and to as many people as possible. It's a whole new propaganda campaign with different tools and almost no filter. It used to be that traditional mainstream media would decide whether images were too harsh, for instance, to put on the air or to publish in a newspaper. Now anybody with a smartphone or a computer connection can see instantly horrifying images that have not been filtered by an editor or a producer.
Who can forget the guy who was tweeting when they were invading the compound where Osama bin Laden was holding out?
Right. That was a fascinating story because this man just heard these helicopters at an unusual time in the middle of the night and started live tweeting. And later he tweeted something that he was the guy who unwittingly tweeted the attack on Osama bin Laden. And had he known about it, he said he would have wittingly tweeted the attack live.
Right. Welcome. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday. My guest right now, Doug Haddix. He's director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Reporting at OSU. And we are talking about social media, wartime social media. If you have a question or comment for Doug, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, is this common now, this practice of social media warfare?
I think it is, but the Israeli Defense Forces have taken it to a new level.
They've made it official.
Right. Part of their Israeli Defense Forces interactive media branch they opened up a few months ago, they have 30 soldiers who are trained in social media and design and images to coordinate their messaging and to respond to messages that are out there. A lot of misinformation, fake photos, all kinds of things happen kind of in the heat of war, just like in the heat of regular news coverage or the heat of a campaign.
Right. I read that the Israeli military's media office gained 50,000 followers in just 24 hours. It made me think about, since when does a media office know anything of value? But that's just 50,000 in 24 hours. How many followers are there now, do you know?
They have about 208,000 followers on their account, so it was a significant jump. And part of it is they started tweeting out links to short videos on their official military YouTube channel of drone attacks. So those became very popular, and over the past few weeks,
the attacks on them, or
the attacks on Hamas operatives in Gaza, the unmanned drones they were equipped with video cameras. So, you know, those images of missiles going down and explosions, and they even posted the attack that killed the Hamas military leader Ahmed al-Jabari, and put out a kind of a wanted poster that he had been eliminated. Once they posted that attack. So they drove a lot of traffic, a lot of interest to their YouTube channel, to their Twitter account, and their blog.
Once again, filling that vacuum.
Absolutely. And trying to take charge of the message and to control the message and to counter any type of message that they disagreed with.
I don't see this kind of scenario popping up so much with the U.S. military yet. I don't hear much about, and maybe I'm mistaken, about U.S. military personnel tweeting things and that sort of.
That is a little bit more under control in our country right now. The military has been quite active in social media. All the branches of the military have YouTube channels. They
right.
have Twitter accounts. But during a combat operation, they have pretty much clamped down that type of live tweeting. And in fact, in Israel, it became an issue once they started calling up the reserves, when there was some sense there might be a ground war. They had not announced that they were calling up the reserves, but people in the reserves started posting photos on Instagram and updating their Facebook status to say, hey, I've been called up and may be going into battle. So the Israeli Defense Forces had to try to put the stop to that because it might be divulging tactical operations or strategies before they were ready to make that public.
Which is, I guess, the Achilles heel of the whole thing.
Right.
Too much information.
Well, it brings transparency on both sides, but it is a double-edged sword because transparency can work against you. It can work for you, but it can give information to the people that you're fighting in real time.
It's interesting because as soon as you try, you know, you buy the tiger, you have to learn how to tame the tiger.
Well, and good luck taming social media.
Right, exactly. We can just talk about it. We can't tame it. It does seem sort of surreal, too, that the news media is covering a Twitter battle while an actual battle is going on. It seems sort of science fiction-like. Is it the future?
It seems virtual in a way that is odd with war, that we're just not used to that. And you're right. The Israeli Defense Forces and the Hamas military wing got into a fight on Twitter with very harsh words and accusations and threats on Twitter, which I think shows how important they view the battle for hearts and minds. It's public opinion has a lot of power, not just in Israel and Palestine, but also around the world, because if Israel comes under diplomatic pressure from its friends and allies for military operations, that can mean dire consequences for the Israelis. So they have to be concerned about what people in the United States and other countries in Europe and beyond think of their operations. So they are very savvy in using social media to put their message out the way they see it.
I heard a great story on NPR this morning about how social media is being used in China to air grievances and air mistreatment of individuals and all these, you know, everything's so local in China in its way. They keep people separated by that. But now with social media, an entire country can coalesce around one person and show support for them. And a woman was freed from prison camp. She had been sent there because she was harassing the local police force for not doing anything about the kidnapping of her 11-year-old daughter. And it really made me think, you know, within like 24 hours, 3 million people were reposting.
Right. There's tremendous power. And that's why you see some governments that want to maintain more control try to crack down. I mean, China has had a lot of issues with Google and social media, and there are a lot of restrictions there. What we saw in Gaza was also interesting because Israel controls all of the telecommunications in the Gaza Strip. So they technically had the power to shut down the internet if they chose to, but they chose not to. And some experts were saying this was the first time in combat that one side controlled all of the telecommunications of the other side that they were battling. So you see people on the Hamas side doing things like getting SIMs cards for cell phones to try to be sure that they could connect to Egyptian cell phone services to keep tweeting, to keep posting information in case the Israelis shut down the infrastructure for telecommunications in Gaza.
I don't know that much about Israeli politics necessarily, but it's kind of surprising that they didn't shut it down.
Well, I think there would have been a backlash beyond Israel if they had done that.
And then people were wondering, in China, why did they let this happen? Well, they said, well, because it was a local conflict, even though 3 million people got involved, if it went to the central government, that would be a different story. But as long as they're just trashing a local police department, they don't care.
Well, and you see these rulers have some sensitivity that it's a fine line and it's a balance, because if you do shut down access to cell phones in Egypt during the uprising or Syria during the government's crackdown on protesters there, there are consequences and it leads to more international outrage. And it might actually help the people you're trying to suppress.
Of course, they did shut down the cell phones and the internet in Iran.
Yes, because they saw the power of people coalescing through social media and sharing images and videos of what was truly going on in Tehran and other cities around the country.
As a journalist, how would you treat Twitter and other social media as sources of breaking news? What are you teaching the, you know, your fellows at the Kiplinger program about how to use it as a source?
We talk about using social media as a tip, just as you would use a telephone call from someone who says, hey, I have information that is newsworthy. You would not go on the air live with that. You would not put that in your newspaper without trying to validate it, without trying to check it out. And Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, it's all the same. Those are starting points, not ending points of information.
You know, we had a caller yesterday say, I saw it on YouTube. What YouTube channel? Well, I don't know. It was just on YouTube. Okay. This had to do with something very unusual idea, which was debunked about the Healthcare Reform Act. What kind of advice would you give consumers of information about how to consume the just incredible amount of information that's coming across the internet, Twitter, Facebook, that sort of thing?
You're right. There's just it's almost like instead of taking a drink of water from the drinking fountain, you have a fire hydrant just immersing you with information, video, images all the time. Again, the filters in the past and the gatekeepers, their role has been blown up in a way by social media because there is no filter. Anyone with a smartphone or a computer can post anything visible to just about anybody in the world instantly. And it is tough for consumers of information to figure out what's real. So I think you have to almost think like a journalist. Who is the source? Where is this coming from? How do they know what they know? Does this photo look like it was taken where they say it was taken? And we had a speaker at our social media summit a couple weeks ago show lots of images after Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast and showed a lot of them that were faked images of these enormous, monstrous clouds engulfing the Statue of Liberty and things like that. You know, the storm came ashore in the middle of the night, so those images just defied logic. But a lot of people believed them, and they reposted them on Facebook or they retweeted them. So a lot of misinformation is out there in real time. So consider the source. Think about where it's coming from. And journalists are now starting to look for ways to try to validate information, including kind of cross-tabulation in a sense. If you see a photo that was allegedly taken in Manhattan, you can go to Google Earth and take a zoomed-in street view of that area to see, are the stores the same? Are things where they are supposed to be? Are the shadows where they should be for that time of day?
I know the Atlantic has worked really hard to do that, you know, after the hurricane.
Yes, and debunking a lot of the misinformation and fake images out there.
Right, exactly. Well, Doug, this is just getting bigger every day, so I'm sure we'll have you on again soon. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, you're welcome.
Doug Haddix, he's director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Reporting at Ohio State University. Coming up, another way to use the internet and use technology when it comes to your DNA. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
When this man speaks, the investing world listens no matter what he says.
You don't need a lot of brains in this business. I mean, I've always said if you got an IQ of 160, give away 30 points to somebody else because you don't need it in investments. What you do need is emotional stability.
But you got to figure he's got some brains. That is, I'm Kai Ryssdal, Warren Buffett, and the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 36 degrees with some sunshine, a high near 40 today. Clear skies tonight and pretty chilly, a low of 23. Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the winter edition, coming December 5th, can be found at ediblecolumbus.com. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Research findings about DNA continually pop up in the news. Just yesterday, it was announced that a group of Chinese scientists have sequenced the genome of watermelon, and medical researchers are studying our genes in hopes of curing and preventing diseases every day. But the technology to read DNA is less and less expensive. It's less and less exotic, and every day more people can afford to get their DNA tested. So why do they do it? One reason is to learn about their family history. Joining us now is Craig Canale. He's a senior editor at The Huffington Post. His recent article describes how he was able to meet distant cousins in Ireland after getting his DNA tested. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Hi, thank you.
Question for our listeners. Have you had your DNA tested to work on your genealogy? Give us a call and share your story. Tell us if you learned anything. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait. It's a short segment. So, Craig, you've been doing family research on sites like Ancestry.com for 12 years. The Internet's given you a real foothold in genealogy to begin with, right?
Yeah, that's right. I've been doing it for a long time, and definitely with the Internet, a lot more records are going online. They're being digitized. It's easier to research.
Eventually, you reached the limit of what you could discover using documents. Why did you decide to get your DNA tested? What had you heard about that? What made you do that?
Well, as you had said earlier, it's getting more affordable. And in the past, it was never really an option. But also, I hit a brick wall in the traditional records for my own family, and specifically for my last name and for that branch of the family. So DNA offered another alternative to learn more about my roots there.
How much did it cost and how did it work?
It was just over $100 on the site that I used. It was called FamilyTreeDNA.com, and I just signed up for it. It was very easy. They sent a packet in the mail and a kit. I did a basic cheek swab, sent it back to their lab, and then a couple months later I got the results.
And what do those results look like? What do they send you?
They send a lot of stuff. It's actually some really advanced numbers and everything. Some of it actually didn't really make sense to me. But they also distill some of it into more understandable terms about whether or not you have any matches, and I did, fortunately, and close matches. And then they tell you how closely you might be related. And they also tell you where your ancestors came from, which line you go back to.
They can tell that from your DNA.
Exactly, yeah. It's gotten really good, the technology.
How personalized is it?
It's really personalized because they'll look at, specifically, I did a Y DNA test, so they look at your Y chromosome, and they really break it down into all these different numbers, and it's extremely personalized in that I found a living relative in Ireland with the same last name as me.
And what are the odds that somebody else has submitted a cheek swab of their own somewhere around the world? Do we know about how many people are doing this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head how many are doing it, but it's certainly only a fraction of the population of the world. So you got to kind of roll the dice and hope that one of your living distant relatives took it also to find them.
But to learn something from your DNA, it's not necessary for a distant somebody
no.
else to have done it. They still would have had plenty of information for you.
That's true. That's right. They can tell you, for instance, like if you go back 20,000, 30,000 years even, which branch of the DNA of the human family you belong to. So, like, I saw my branch went back to the Middle East, and then they came to Western Europe, according to my findings. So they'll give you information like that and other information.
So you had already booked a trip to Ireland before you received the information back. Tell us about the trip.
That's exactly right. I've always wanted to go to Ireland since I was a kid, and my dad found a really great deal online, actually, said, "This sounds like you." And it was a trip for one. It was, like, really tailor-made to me. So I was going, and then I decided to do the DNA since I was going. I said, I might as well. You never know. So then I went. I got the results back 3 months before the trip, and then I kind of scrambled. Unfortunately, I was able to meet one of the relatives.
Tell us about meeting somebody in that way. Was it just a crapshoot for them too? Were you a surprise to them?
Definitely a surprise for them. Apparently, they had done the test like 5 years ago. It was an older man, and it was his cousin in Australia who encouraged him to take the test because her mother was a Kennelly, which is my last name, and you can only do it through male relatives. Hmm. So she asked her cousin, her mother's cousin, to take the test. And so he took it, and he was really surprised. I gave him a phone call, actually, and we talked about it, and he said, "Let us know when you're in Ireland."
So why male relatives only? What's the issue there?
It deals with just the Y chromosome for the specific test that I did,
okay,
which is only passed from male to male, from father to son. But there are other tests, too, and there are maternal tests as well that will only look through your mother's that passes from mother to daughter genes as well.
So when you went to Ireland, tell us about what you saw and what you did in relationship to your genealogy.
Yeah, I like I said before, I was doing the research for more than 10 years, and I had a lot of information already. Some of the towns my family was from in Ireland, so I visited each of those towns. I met with locals, asked questions if they knew any of the family names, and I just really drove around the whole country. It was really fun.
Do you have any advice for somebody else doing what you did? I mean, are there lots of providers of this DNA testing?
Yeah, there are a lot more now than there used to be. The one I used, Family Tree DNA, was outstanding. And actually, Ancestry.com just started doing DNA testing as well, brand new for them. So they offer it too. And there's a lot of other sites that do it now also.
Now, I heard that I think you wrote about this. You found this cemetery where you knew that a relative was buried. This was from your previous genealogy research.
Exactly. Yeah, that was probably the most emotional part of my entire trip, actually, even more so than meeting the distant cousin through DNA, was when I went to an old cemetery from the early 1800s, and I knew one of my ancestors was buried there during the potato famine. And because it was during the potato famine, a lot of people died in this small town that I visited, and they had mass burials. So he didn't have a headstone, but just like knowing he was there and the presence that he was there, and my family would have been to that same cemetery before they immigrated, I thought it was really powerful.
It's interesting, this conjunction of technology and something as basic as our family trees.
Yes. It is, and it's amazing how much is out there now that you can find. I mean, without technology, I wouldn't be able to have found all the information I found and to find these towns that I visited.
Talk about using Ancestry.com and how you got started with that.
Yeah, it goes back many years. So Ancestry.com is a paid, you have to pay to use it,
mm-hmm.
but they also offer free services. So I would say the majority of the time that I've used Ancestry.com, I stick to their free things. And I also use a site called FamilySearch.org, which is 100% free, and that's run by the Mormons, so it's a really excellent site.
And how does it work? Do you just put in your name, or how do you get started with something like that?
Yeah, I think the easiest way for like anybody interested in it is you just start with your grandparents' names is the best way. For living individuals, there's not as much data on the internet, so if you start with grandparents and great-grandparents, if you know their names, you find them in the census records to start, and then you go from there and get their parents' names and their parents' names, and you just see where it goes. And then you'll find towns they're from and places back in Europe, and that's where you really get into it.
How do they dish up the information? Do they send you documents, or do they send you references to documents? How does that work?
For which site?
Well, when you put in your grandparents' names, what do they spit back out?
Yeah, you're basically just searching a bunch of databases that are indexed now. So that includes like census records. A lot of church records now are indexed. You're searching vital records, birth, marriage, death, county, state records. And then increasingly more and more of the European records are being digitized also. So it's really interesting, actually, because like 5 or 10 years ago, there was not nearly as much information on the internet as there is now. So it's become easier than ever for people to search online for their family tree.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Greg Canale. He's a senior editor for Big News and Live Events for The Huffington Post. We're talking about his adventure after getting his DNA tested, traveling to Ireland and meeting very distant cousins or relatives, I suppose I should say, because of the DNA match. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you had some advice for people about, do you have a favorite registry or a favorite service that you like to work through, or is it a good idea to work through more than one?
I actually think FamilySearch.org is my favorite because it is free, and it's run by the Mormons, and the Mormons have excellent records. They've been doing this for a long time, and it's really important to them, actually, to learn more about their family history and their ancestors. So I think FamilySearch.org is the best, and Ancestry.com is also excellent, and there's a site that I like also. It's worldconnect.rootsweb.com, and they have family trees that people have already compiled, so you can search for your names in there.
We have an email from Amber. She asks, can the DNA test determine which American Indian tribe someone is from?
Wow, really good question. I don't know if it can get that specific. Actually, I'm not sure on that question.
You know, I was wondering, you mentioned that your distant relative had submitted the swab 5 years ago. Did you find that the Irish people you met, at least, have as much interest in connecting with their distant relatives in the United States as we do with learning more about our genealogy?
Yeah, I think so. Just because when I was traveling the country and telling people that I was looking for my roots and going from town to town, even in the very rural parts, there was always an interest from the locals, and there was always that very welcoming and how can we help you, and directing me to resources. So I think they are interested in this sort of thing. The other thing, really quick, is Ireland's doing this thing called Gathering 2013 next year, and it's a big tourism initiative where they're trying to get people in the United States to go back and from around the world to go back to their Irish roots and visit where their families came from. So they're making a big tourism initiative, too, out of it and trying to get people to go back to their roots next year.
Are you going to go?
I'm actually not, because I just did.
Okay.
But I found out about this after when I was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike in Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi. Hey, I was just wondering, you know, newspapers today, the obituaries and things like that, they always give the maiden names and things like that. Is there a site on the internet that I can go to find newspaper articles about an old relative or something?
Yeah, there's a bunch of sites that will allow you to do that. Ancestry.com is one of them. And like I said, it is a paid subscription service, but they're indexing more and more newspapers. And actually, if you Google around or go to the individual newspaper sites, more and more of them are indexing and archiving their old issues to search for things like that.
So even the Columbus Dispatch, even?
Yeah, it would be best to check with them individually, like go to their website. Another thing, actually, I just remembered, there's a site, legacy.com, and they're indexing obituaries and death notices from all across the country.
So legacy.com.
Legacy.com, yeah, and that one's free to search. They have indexes for the whole country for death notices.
Thank you,
Mike. For the ones, Craig, that do charge, what are we talking about when you talk about these subscriptions? How expensive is it generally?
It depends on the service. I guess you're probably talking, Ancestry.com can be as expensive as $30 or $40 a month. But that's not giving you access to all of their international holdings as well. But it's not always that expensive.
just depends.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. This is not technological, but did you notice a family resemblance?
Yes.
That's kind of weird, isn't it?
It is very weird. We were like blown away when we were going through old family pictures. I brought some and then they brought out their old family albums. And we definitely saw it. As soon as I showed a picture of my dad, they're like, wow, that's definitely a Canelli. It was really crazy.
And are they going to travel here?
I don't know if they can. I definitely invited them. If they're ever here, like, they're welcome, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, Craig Canelli, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We really appreciate it. That's Craig Canelli. He's senior editor of Big News and Live Events for Huffington Post. Coming up, bring your questions. We've got Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. He's going to be talking about, you know, his ideas for Christmas and holiday gifts this season. And if you have any questions about anything, we're still trying to stump Russell Holley. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The next Fresh Air, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. We talk with Gregory Johnson about his new book, The Last Refuge. It explains the rise, fall, and resurrection of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which continues to plot attacks against the U.S. Johnson is a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen and works in the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton University. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join WOSU-TV Wednesday night to address the crisis of obesity and chronic disease plaguing America. Dr. Joel Fuhrman has a revolutionary health plan that is not about willpower, it's about knowledge. It offers a healthy, effective, and scientifically proven plan for shedding weight and reclaiming good health. Watch Three Steps to Incredible Health Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. Some sunshine today, a high of 40, clear skies tonight, a low of 23. Support for 89.7 comes from the Methodist Theological School in Ohio, a gateway to lives of lasting significance. MTSO prepares religious leaders to guide and serve their communities with intellectual integrity and a commitment to justice. More at mtso.edu. And support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. November is Personal Healthcare Month in Ohio, and the Wexner Medical Center wants to help people live a healthier, happier life. Information on how to join the Wexner Medical Center and make a pledge to live healthy is at medicalcenter.osu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Black Friday and Cyber Monday are over, but I bet you still haven't finished your holiday shopping list. Joining us now to continue his list is Geek.com blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So any surprises for you about what was out there on Black Friday, on Cyber Monday? Any great deals out there that surprised you, I should say?
There were a lot of really impressive things. You know, we talked briefly about some of the flash drives that that I saw that were, you know, on you know, really crazy deals, but also regular, you know, computer hard drives for people who like to do, you know, self-expansion for their own equipment. I saw there was a 1 terabyte hard drive made by three different companies, actually, that were priced below $100. You know, just, you know, really, really great prices on that kind of stuff.
Did you get anything?
I got some stuff for Cyber Monday for the kids. I got a couple of games.
You don't want them to hear it. Okay.
Oh, they're not. They're in school.
Okay. So just a lot of stuff. I got online a little bit yesterday to check it out, but I didn't have time to order anything. I just was too busy. It is crazy. They're saying something like did it double or it increased it by double digits, the number of people buying on Cyber Monday?
It really wouldn't surprise me at all to see that many, but I find I find I'm having a little bit of problem, identifying what happened as Cyber Monday, because really a lot of these online sales started, on Black Friday, and they continued through until Monday instead of just being on Monday. It was really, the entire weekend, especially for sites like Amazon that had, the kind of deals every hour where they shuffled out new things every hour. That happened all weekend long. So it wouldn't surprise me that there were, a lot more people, but it was also available for way longer than has typically been available.
You wanted to talk about Wii U. It's sold out through March. I was wondering what the selling point was, because I remember lots of criticisms of Wii U.
So the Wii U console is Nintendo's latest thing, and they sold, when I expected when the games console was released that it was going to sell out. But I also kind of expected a couple of retailers to have, 15 or 20 kind of squirreled away for Black Friday or Cyber Monday, and that mm-hmm. didn't happen at all. I couldn't find a single location that was, that had them on, kind of a special deal to encourage you to come to the store. As for the criticism that it received, a large portion of the problems with the Wii U came from, kind of the out-of-the-box experience. The initial setup required an update that took a really long time to install, especially if you didn't have the fastest internet connection. I had a couple people report that the initial update took as long as 2.5 hours. Which is especially troubling given that the battery on the big controller that comes with it only lasts 3 hours to begin with.
Jeez.
So by the time you got it all set up, you had to recharge your controller before you could even play the game. So I definitely see that as being a problem. One of the things that I found when the game was actually set up and when you were actually ready to play was that it was a really smooth experience. It's just that startup. It was a really bumpy startup, and that's really out of character for Nintendo to have those kind of problems. So it'll be interesting to see how they move forward with that. But the overall experience, I think, is really positive.
Is it worth going to all the trouble to make the change?
So it's a whole new console. It's a whole new way of playing the games, and it gives you access to, high definition games. The original Wii doesn't have high definition graphics. So if you have, a high definition television that you're connecting the game console to, you're not going to get the best experience. The whole idea of playing with the gamepad that has its own screen built in really changes the way a lot of games play, even games that are available on other consoles like the Xbox and the PlayStation. For example, Assassin's Creed 3 is a title that's available on pretty much everything, but it really offers a unique gameplay experience on the Wii U by being able to use both screens side by side to accomplish goals.
When people are developing games, are they having to develop on them a lot of different levels for the different gaming systems?
Oh yeah, that's pretty much the same any way you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're gonna have those same problems with any console. Each console has their own specific things that you have to compensate for, which is why you often find titles that aren't available on every single thing.
So anyways, the Wii U is sold out through March. Do you think people should just wait? Is it worth giving as a gift?
I definitely feel like it's worth giving as a gift, especially if you are interested in a game console that acts as, it also doubles as a smart TV. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about the Wii U is that it has access to Netflix and Hulu Plus and Amazon and all of these features, but it also gives you control of your television. You can control volume, change channels. You can really use it as the center of your entertainment center, which is something that, Microsoft has been trying pretty hard to do with the Xbox, but it has definitely not come near as close as Nintendo did with this.
So you also wanted to talk about 3D printers. We've talked about them before. They're really being marketed for individuals now.
Well, that was the big thing that we talked about before, was mm-hmm. that eventually these were going to become, at a price point that was reasonable. We saw a lot of these 3D printers that were, $1,500 and $1,000. And really, for something that a lot of people kind of struggle to understand to begin with as far as how useful it would be in the house, asking them to pay $1,000 for something like that is really something that's just not going to drive adoption. But there's a couple of different companies that have been trying really hard to drive the cost down. And one of them has been able to get it down under $500.
Exactly, under $500. You saying they have achieved that or not?
Yeah, the Portobee is a $480 printer.
Okay.
It's the design, you know, is you know, a lot more mechanical than something you'd see from the MakerBot replicator, but that's, again, a $2,000 printer. So it's something that you end up kind of, it's a very do-it-yourself kit. You put it together yourself, and you can actually have a lot of the parts for it 3D printed, which is kind of a funny way of thinking about how they get made. But once you have it all set up, you do have a functional 3D printer for, you know, $480.
Let's take us through the idea of what a 3D printer does. It's 3D, but what do you feed into the printer versus what do you get out of it?
So it takes a plastic, the easiest way to think of it is a plastic string, maybe a little bit thicker than a fishing wire. And it feeds it through a machine that heats it up and places it on this cooling pad, you know, it places it in dots. And it takes the dots and it draws things with the dots very much the same way that an old dot matrix printer would, where it draws the individual dots. It takes the heated plastic and dabs it on a plate. And then it takes, you know, it prints one whole layer of something, but then it can continue to print layers on top of itself until it constructs a three-dimensional image. But it's a physical thing that you can pick up and hold afterwards that you've created.
So could I is it something you take a picture of and put in there, or do you have to give it a lot of instruction?
It doesn't require a lot of instruction, but it does require 3D modeling software, which is all free and available on the mm-hmm. web now. And it's something that, you know, there are so many different resources now that offer, you know, just basic shapes that you can make. And you can, if you have, you know, the right kind of camera, take a three-dimensional image of something and feed it into one of these printers and have it replicate, you know, that item. It's really just, you know, kind of taking yourself from printing a piece of paper and moving it to, you know, I need something or I want to do something. You know, I can, instead of, you know, shopping online for a place where somebody has manufactured a couple hundred thousand of these, I can look and see what I can do to make it myself.
Okay, so what would that be, though? What kind of widget are we talking about?
So it could really be anything. Let's say, you know, you have a unique design for what you want a case for your smartphone to be. You know, you have a unique design for your iPhone. You can actually, you know, have that printed. Or if you have a more industrial, you know, kind of strength 3D printer, and you decide that you really want a unique design for curtain rods, you can print those curtain rods and hang them, you know, exactly the same way you would hang curtain rods that you bought in the store. It's really anything that you can conceive. And that's what I think causes the disconnect there, is that it really isn't limited by anything other than your imagination and how big your 3D printer is.
Yeah, okay. That was the other thing, is the size. How big of an object can the $480 printer print or create?
It's not a huge stand. You've basically got a 2-foot by 2-foot cube that you can print inside, but you can also, you know, print designs that have interlocking pieces so that you can print multiple things and then connect them together and make one, you know, significantly larger thing.
Do you have one, Russell?
I do have a 3D printer, but it's not here in my house. I have a workshop that a couple of friends use a 3D printer, and we've done some pretty interesting things with them.
Like what?
Well, I have a case for my phone. I actually I broke, you know, the shelves that you get from the kind of cheap bookcases.
Yeah.
Where it's just got the little notches that you put in, the pegs that you put in the thing.
Yeah.
I actually broke three of those pegs by putting something way too heavy on one of those shelves. And I took one of the pegs and actually printed three more of them and fixed the shelf.
Were you able to do it in the right color? Because one of the limitations is color.
Well, you can get color, and you can get any color filament you want.
Okay.
You can order them from anywhere. So yeah, it's just, you know, as soon as I found the right color filament, I could print it out. Most people that are playing with this, you know, print in kind of a generic white until they find exactly what they want, and then they get colors. And there are a lot of the more expensive units that actually allow for multiple colors at once so that it can, you know, kind of intelligently switch between them and make multicolor, you know, units.
Is it expensive to operate a 3D printer?
It's not expensive. It doesn't require much more power than a regular paper printer. It takes a little longer, you mm-hmm. know, because you're dealing with a three-dimensional structure. But really, you know, the case that I made for my phone took an hour and 45 minutes from start to finish. You know, and that was, you know, the time that I put into the 3D modeling software and the time that it took to actually print it.
Mike in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you a question about the evolution of this 3D printer, because I've worked in CAD/CAM for close to 30 years now, and I recall way back when you could get machines. They cost about $250,000. They were called stereolithography. Is this the descendant of the stereolithography technology? The stereolithography basically used a laser to kind of like grow the part in a polymer bath, and it would take a digitized image, and then it would take this laser, and you'd see the thing grow in this bath right in front of your eyes, and it was made out of, what it was actually made out of was some kind of plastic, but they had, in the meantime, they've had all different kinds of them that make them out of layers of paper, make them out of powdered metal, things like that. Is this similar? Is the 3D printer similar?
Russell?
The 3D printer has a similar end result, but instead of taking a large source material and working down until you get what you want, you're actually taking a filament of plastic and almost, I guess the easiest way to you know, kind of describe it, it would almost be like using icing on a cake, where you're building something with icing. You make a whole bunch of smaller strokes to create a three-dimensional shape. If you've ever seen someone make, anything out of icing piping, where they make, you know, like the flowers and stuff like that, that uses a lot of the same basic concepts.
Okay, Mike, thanks.
Okay, I have a follow-up.
Sure.
And does the filament move? Does it move inside the printer and like lay this down?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. I got it. Thanks.
Take care, Mike. My guest, once again, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We've been talking about the 3D printer. If you have a question or comment for Russell about anything, any ideas for Christmas or any other holiday gifts you want to run by him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at @WOSUAllSides as well, or check out our Facebook page. Email from Susan. She asks, does your guest have any comments regarding Republic Wireless?
I have lots of comments regarding Republic Wireless.
Of course
I've actually
you do, but
used
first,
them a couple
what
of
is
times.
Republic Wireless?
So Republic Wireless is a cell phone carrier that takes Sprint service and uses it as kind of a fallover for what they hope is a wireless carrier that only uses the majority of the time your wireless network to make phone calls and send text messages and things like that. So when you go to make or receive a phone call, if you are at home or in the office and you're connected to a wireless network, instead of using Sprint or Verizon or AT&T, you're actually using your existing wireless internet connection to place phone calls. And as long as you're connected to a network that has, you know, a good stable connection, it's a really high quality, audio that you're transferring, you know, back and forth, and the calls sound really exactly the same as they would on a cell network.
Okay. See, Carol in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to get maybe a new printer sometime soon. The one we have is an HP. It came with our newest Mac, which is 3 years old, or desktop, and it's wireless. But, of course, they're not very good with upgrading the software as the Apple, operating system upgrades. You know, HP isn't very good at. But anyway, I want a printer that will just do black ink if I want. It won't be screaming for to fill in the colored cartridge, because I don't print a lot of stuff. You know what I'm saying? And I'm finding it really frustrating with this printer, because they tell me the colored ink is out. I don't want color. Why can't it just use the black? But I hear that there's some out there that actually do print with just black if you want to choose that. Do you know of any? Can you recommend
That's
any?
That's an interesting question. Actually, a pretty good question.
What you're basically looking for is a printer that doesn't have the photo capabilities.
I don't use that stuff anyway because I find it really technically a pain in the butt. If I want to make a photo, I'll take a photo that into the Walgreens and make a print there. But
sure.
It's so much easier. But they always come with color in black. But this one doesn't give you. It does give you a quick choice of black. But I don't know. It was screaming about the printer ink was out. Well, I actually had to call HP, and they charged me $30 for a half hour of information. But she did send me a link to upgrade the printer driver so that I could run it again wirelessly, because I think it kind of started acting up when I moved to Lion 7.4. But she told me that there are printers out there that you can just choose black or white or colored if you want.
What do you know, Russell?
Anything that's not a photo printer really has basic settings that will allow you to choose, black only or white only. And really, I know that this is a lot easier in Windows than it is in OS X, especially in Lion. But there's default settings in the printer, settings themselves on the computer that you can choose to force black only or black and color. The printer section in Windows makes that really easy to force, and it's in OS X, but it's hidden in the printer settings. Off the top of my head, I don't know exactly how to get there, but it definitely works. Instead of pushing it from instead of looking for a printer that does that, you can actually do it from the computer.
All right, Carol, thanks a lot for your call.
Uh-huh.
Okay, take care. Jerry in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hi, I've got a question. I've been looking for some holographic business cards. I have a younger sister who's a magician, and she just became a member of the Academy of Magical Arts, which just sounds to me like such fun, and I'd love to get her some holographic business cards. Would a 3D printer print those?
No, those are going to come out not only thicker than normal business cards, but they're also going to be not holographic. They're just going to be three-dimensional, which is a little different. Really, holographic business cards, the easiest place to look for things like that would be, professional print shops.
Well, I've been to every professional print shop I can find, and I've Googled it. Nobody seems to make those kinds of things, and I can't imagine that they aren't made somewhere.
I don't know, Jerry. I smell a niche for you.
I think so. Well, I think she would love them, and I think they'd be very, very cool to have.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
I don't
idea.
Know where in the world to find them.
Okay, well, if anybody out there has an idea for that, post it at the Facebook page or... you're welcome. Post it on Facebook if you have an idea about where to get a holographic business card. And thanks, Jerry, for the call. Russell, we're just about out of time, so I guess we'll have to return to our holiday gift guide next week.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Thank the All Sides crew, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Glackler, our production assistants Katie Higgins, Leticia Wiggins, and Rose Joe. Video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.